Basically, it's to listen, to find out what rural residents have to say about the challenges they face, and to hear what solutions they might propose.
The state's Rural Action Subcabinet heads to Western Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Friday, the 11th of September. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, Pacific Brant decide to stay in Alaska rather than fly south.
Alaska used to be just a minor blip on their winter distribution and now comprises the biggest wintering population.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future, and by Alaska Communication Systems, converging voice, video, internet, and data applications for business. ACS connects companies from the North Slope to Ketchikan to each other and the rest of the world.
The Rural Action Subcabinet will hold the first of a series of hearings in Western Alaska next week. Attorney General Daniel Sullivan, Commerce Commissioner Emil Noddy, and Transportation Commissioner Leo von Schaben will be available to meet with the public in Unalakleet Monday afternoon. Sullivan will continue to Kotzebue for a public meeting on Wednesday. Bill McAllister is Sullivan's spokesman.
Basically, it's to listen, to find out what rural residents have to say about the challenges they face, and to hear what solutions they might propose. And this is the first of what will be a couple or a few trips to rural Alaska in preparation of some recommendations for the governor's consideration, hopefully by December.
McAllister says the administration is serious about addressing the problems they know exist in rural Alaska, and they want input from those who live there. He says this and future trips are part of the fact gathering the subcabinet is doing, along with accepting suggestions from the public at the email address established at attorney.general@alaska.gov. The Unalakleet meeting with the public will be from 2 to 4 Monday afternoon in the community hall. The Kotzebue meeting will be held from 10 to noon at the Northwest Arctic Borough Assembly Chambers. A U.S.-Canadian expedition to the Arctic is unlocking new information about what lies beneath the ocean's surface and may aid the countries as they claim Arctic resources. Icebreakers from the two nations have been on a shared mission in the Beaufort Sea for the past month. They're mapping the continental shelf and conducting scientific research. Working in tandem, the two ships plowed through icy waters previously unexplored, according to Natural Resources Canada Director Dr. Jacob Verhoff.
The collaboration between the two ships has been excellent for the second year in a row. What is important is that we collected large amounts of high-quality scientific data. We have almost doubled, actually, our seismic data holdings in the northern Canada Basin, and in many of these areas, this was the first time that we were able to get there.
Verhoff says they collected 40% more data than anticipated and went 2 degrees farther north than expected. He says they mapped the ocean floor looking for clues as to where the outer continental shelf might end.
In the area of the Beaufort Sea, the Canada Basin, there is a significant amount of sediments. And that significant amount of sediments is one of the scientific criteria by which we can define our outer limits of a continental shelf. So in that sense, the data collection will probably help us a lot in defining that outer limit.
That's important because countries are racing to map and stake the Arctic for its resources and shipping potential. If countries can prove to the United Nations that their outer continental shelf extends into disputed territory, it can help with their claims. There are areas the U.S. and Canada disagree over, but David Balton, the U.S. Deputy Assistant Secretary of State for Oceans and Fisheries, says they did not collect joint data in those hot-button areas.
The data we are collecting and beginning to analyze now are not being collected and analyzed for the purpose of resolving the U.S.-Canadian boundary. It's being collected and analyzed for the purpose of figuring out how far from shore the continental shelf extends.
The ships took turns breaking ice and gathering data. The U.S. vessel, the Healy, collected bathymetric data, which shows the shape and depth of the ocean floor. The Canadian icebreaker, the Louis St. Laurent, collected seismic data. The ship's crew spoke to reporters Thursday on a teleconference from their position in the Arctic Ocean. The Louis St. Laurent's chief scientist, David Mosher, says while seismic technology has been around for decades, it had never been used so far north.
blowing it through ice in the Arctic is quite uncommon. And so it's the first time that many of these regions to where we're going have been seen both below the seafloor and an impression of what the seafloor looks like laterally.
During their exploration, the crews found what they called remarkable features, including what they believe is an underwater volcano and a seamount or ridge that runs 16 miles long. The icebreakers will conclude their mission on September 16th. They plan to do it again next summer for a third season of shared research. A common sea goose is providing new evidence of how climate change is affecting our state. A federal study indicates that many Pacific brant, which breed in Alaska, are choosing to remain here all winter rather than migrate to sunnier climates. As APRN's Ellen Lockyer reports, the new trend could mean more food for subsistence hunters, but it could also mean danger for an already dwindling brant population.
David Ward is a research biologist with the U.S. Geological Survey's Alaska Science Center. He says studies show that as many as 40,000 brant remain in Alaska during the winter. That's about 30% of the entire Pacific brant population.
Well, it means their winter distribution is shifted northward, and they're, right now the population is under decline. So we're trying to determine what factors may be leading to these declines.
Ward is the lead author of the USGS study. He pins the bird's reluctance to follow traditional migration patterns on warming temperatures in the Bering Sea and North Pacific.
It's more of a connection with climate change than anything else. The birds now have habitat in winter at Eisenbeck Lagoon, their primary staging area, which they use to jumpstart their migrations south to Mexico.
Ward's research is focused on the birds of the Yukon-Kuskokwim Delta. He says studies began in the mid-1970s when fewer than 3,000 brant wintered over. The brant live in coastal estuaries and feed primarily on eelgrass, a food which fattens them up for the winter migration and which is available in abundance in Mexico. But do a few degrees in temperature mean that much to the birds?
Well, it does. When you drop a degree Celsius, it changes ice conditions, weather patterns. The Aleutian Low, which they use to migrate south to Mexico, has shifted in a more northerly pattern. So there are fewer days now that we found for them to migrate south and catch the tailwind.
He says the temperature increase has not only shifted the storm systems that used to push the birds south, but has melted the ice that covered the eelgrass. Ward says Alaska eelgrass feeds the birds, and they will stay if it is available. Federal biologists have been keeping data on the brant for 50 years. Ward says the data gives a good snapshot of climate change's effect on a species.
Alaska used to be just a minor blip on their winter distribution and now comprises the biggest wintering population north of Mexico.
He says it is expected that more of the birds will stay here as temperatures warm, but he cautions that the birds could face additional danger if cold snaps freeze over their eelgrass supply. For APRN, I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, tracking the route of fresh produce on its way to Alaska.
We can come in here with a 58-degree banana and have gone through 70-below weather.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by GrantStation, your fast track to funding, on the web at grantstation.com, serving Alaskan organizations for over 10 years. And by the Doyon family of companies working together to build Alaska's future.
Getting fresh fruit and vegetables to Alaska is no easy task. A lot of it is slowly barged up from the lower 48, but the most perishable items make their way to the state by truck through Canada over the remote and grueling Alaska Highway. APRN's Annie Feit caught up with two drivers who team up for the long journey and has their story.
The back of Mike Casey's semi-truck is filled with lettuce, apples, and watermelons, but he might as well be carrying gold. He remembers a time he pulled over at a wide spot on a highway in Alaska. A tour bus idled nearby.
The tour bus driver starts waving at me, Hold up, hold up. He says, are you the ones that are bringing the produce up? He says, I'm from the lower 48 about 20 years ago. And he says, fresh produce. That's the one thing me and my wife have missed for so long. He says, the variety and the quality.
On this day, Mike and his driving partner, Rod Berger, are easing the truck into the loading bay at Walmart's Wasilla Supercenter.
Pop our seals here, get the doors open.
They've spent less than 3 days driving 2,600 miles from the company's warehouse in northern Oregon. Walmart's alternative, a barge, would have taken more than a week. The truck is specially outfitted to make the long trip. It has moose lights and air ride suspension to handle the frost heaves. Rod says the produce can be heated or cooled to precise temperatures in three different compartments.
And I'm pretty proud of that fact, that we can come in here with a 58-degree banana and have gone through 70 below weather.
The men carry survival gear along with the produce. The route takes them through British Columbia and the Yukon Territory. During the 8 months of winter, they negotiate snowy mountain passes and have to keep a constant lookout for bison marching along the road. Rod was part of the first Walmart team that made a run to Alaska 2 years ago. But for Mike, it took some convincing.
I had no desire to do this. I'd tell everybody, I'd tell Rod.
Until I finally got him to come up here.
I told Rod, just bring back some pictures. I'm interested in that. Other than that, I had a million reasons for not doing it. And I just absolutely fell in love with it. This is the way I want to retire, coming up here.
There aren't many two-person teams left in Walmart's private fleet of trucks. But for the long Alaska runs, it's necessary. Rod and Mike drive straight through, switching off every 11 hours to rest in one of the bunks in the sleeper compartment. Rod gives a tour of the amenities.
We have the upper and lower bunk in the back, microwave, refrigerator, extra storage.
Rod says on a team, making sure your partner has a good rest and a safe ride is always the focus.
Some really good long-term million-mile solo drivers never make good team drivers because they can't adapt to that aspect of always thinking of the other person first. You know, the way you close the door, the way you stop, the way you set your brakes, the way you shift.
The men work 2 weeks on, 1 week off. The round trip takes about 5 days. Mike says it might seem monotonous, but he never gets tired of making the run.
It's just kind of you and the road. You may drive for 3 or 4 hours and not see another vehicle. And I don't know, it's kind of, I was thinking about it today, and it's, when I was a young kid, I always wanted to be a cowboy. Just get on a horse and just go and go and go. And I'm much more comfortable in this truck, but that's exactly the way I feel.
Rod and Mike say it's like a vacation road trip. Week after week, they get paid to visit some of the most beautiful places on Earth. Even wintertime has its own rewards, especially at minus 70. For APRN.
Can I do a sign off?
Sure.
Even though the car guys would want to run down the up escalator when they hear me say it, this is NPR.
And I'm Annie Feit in Anchorage.
Scientists say increasing levels of CO2 and other gases in the atmosphere are warming the planet and causing the oceans to become more acidic, threatening aquatic life and the livelihoods of commercial fishermen. Last Sunday afternoon in Homer's Mud Bay, a group of fishermen and other mariners sent out a giant SOS distress signal on the water to raise awareness of the issue. KBBI's Marcia Lynn reports.
10 through 14!
In the bright afternoon sun, kayakers organized on the beach at Mud Bay. A blueprint mapped out how they would be grouped on the water to spell the words acid ocean within the giant SOS formed by larger boats. One paddler explained her reasons for taking part in the event.
Art and politics. It's great that the two are coming together and we're making a great statement and it's a good action and hopefully Congress and President will listen to us about climate change.
At the docks along the Homer Spit, fishing and recreational boats were getting ready to launch and head toward Mud Bay. Brad Warren of Sustainable Fisheries Partnership, a group that works with fisheries worldwide to effect positive change, was about to hop aboard one of the vessels. Warren says ocean acidification is a problem he simply could not ignore.
I spent more than 20 years in the fishing industry running fishing industry trade publications. I left that because seeing what was coming with CO2, it was very clear that knowing who I knew and what I knew, I'd have trouble living with myself if I didn't take it on. This is the kind of problem that is a global threat to the future of fisheries. This is the question of whether the oceans are fit to make the kind of life we eat or not.
He says Alaskan fishermen are fighting to keep their jobs and their lifestyle.
There's a lot of money and a lot of jobs, a lot of people's family and legacies at stake. There are many families here where the generation that's fishing today wants their children to be able to come up behind them and do the same.
Rachel Brennan of Halibut Cove powers toward Mud Bay on her 22-foot skiff to join other vessels tied up to buoys anchored in a circle around the kayakers. Her husband has been a commercial fisherman for more than 40 years, and she wants to help raise public awareness of ocean acidification.
Well, I'm here because I'm excited to bring attention to our oceans, and this is how we make our living. We're halibut fishermen, and we really believe in fishing, clean fishing practices, and taking care of our oceans for future generations.
As the boat display was in the final stage of being formed, a fog bank rolled in, temporarily grounding the helicopter carrying the photographers. In a skiff on the water, John Quigley, aerial artist who designed the SOS formation, was shouting directions through a bullhorn and urging boaters to cheer for sunshine. It worked, and the fog parted long enough for the photo shoot to be completed. Organizers of the event hope it will urge Alaska's legislators and political leaders worldwide to take action on the issue of climate change. In Homer, I'm Marcia Lynn.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station. The U.S. Bankruptcy Court for the District of Oregon has set a deadline for filing claims for anyone who has suffered injury by sexual, mental, or physical abuse or misconduct by a Jesuit priest or others, claiming the Society of Jesus Oregon Province has some responsibility. The deadline is November 30th, 2009. Proof of claim forms are available online or by calling 1-888-909-0100. This message is sponsored by the Society of Jesus Oregon Province.
A new cabin is currently being installed in the Wrangell Ranger District. Not only is it the district's first road-accessible cabin, it's also the district's first log cabin. The logs are second-growth timber from the Stargavin Valley in Sitka. KSTK's Lisa Fu caught a ride out to the Middle Ridge cabin site, talked with the building crew, and has this story.
The Middle Ridge cabin site is located 19 miles out of town. In order to get there, you drive out Zamovia Highway, follow Pat's Creek Road to Middle Road, also known as Forest Service Road 560, and head south up the mountain, way up, all the way up to 1,500 feet elevation.
Which doesn't sound like much, but it's kind of quite familiar. Your ears popping as you go up the hill. For Wrangell Island, it's pretty high for the road system.
That's Keith Appleman, recreation technician for the Wrangell Ranger District. He says getting to Middle Ridge involves driving on some of Wrangell Island's steepest roads. It should also involve a high-clearance vehicle, but the upside is you can drive right to the cabin. Middle Ridge is about to become the site of Wrangell's first road-accessible cabin. Appleman says it will be popular with snow machiners, but it'll also be a good recreational opportunity in the summer.
A place where people can take their family or kids and not worry about boats and tides and all that kind of stuff. And of course, it'd be a lot less expensive too, at least to get there.
Although the drive to Middle Ridge can be bumpy and long, Appleman points out some worthy scenery along the way.
This is kind of a neat viewpoint here. You can look out toward, you know, Chichikov Pass and Circle Bay and look towards Rebel, and then you can actually, off to the left, you can see the back channel too.
When we finally get to Middle Ridge, the crew, a mix of AmeriCorps volunteers and paid Forest Service staff, are hard at work. They are drilling holes into the first round of logs that will be fastened to the concrete foundation. From there, they will start stacking, each round of logs getting pinned down with wood pegs to the row below. These spruce logs are second-growth timber from the Stargavin Valley in Sitka. That area was originally clear-cut in the late 60s and early 70s before it was designated a recreation area. Stargavin currently features the first log cabin to be built with this second-growth timber. Middle Ridge now has the second. The cabin was originally built back in May during a log cabin construction class, which took place at the University of Alaska's Sitka campus. After all the logs were cut, notched, and put together, they were disassembled and barged to Wrangell to be put back together again. Fairbanks resident Richard Music was one of the teachers of the log building class. He's now in Wrangell for the first week of assembling at Middle Ridge. In only a few days, he hopes to get all the logs restacked, the doors and windows cut in, and the roof put on.
All the logs are already cut and fit and labeled. You can see that on the end of each log has a number and a location. So once we get this bottom round attached securely to the foundation, stacking it will go fairly quickly.
Music was also responsible for the construction and assembling of the log cabin in Stargavin, which has received high use since its completion. Music anticipates the same for Middle Ridge.
Once people find out about it and come up, it's a great place to hang out, go berry picking in the fall and snow machining in the winter and just hang out in the summertime. And it's road accessible.
The exterior of the cabin, as well as the installation of the wood stove and the outhouse, are due for completion by the end of October. The Forest Service hopes the interior of the cabin, like the bunk beds, the shelves, and the counters, will be built through a partnership with Wrangell High School. The final completion of the Middle Ridge cabin site, including a wood shed and picnic tables, won't be done until next year. In Wrangell, I'm Lisa Fu.
The Indian Health Service has awarded a $91 million contract for construction of the new Norton Sound Regional Hospital in Nome. The 150,000-square-foot building will replace a 61-year-old hospital. It will be owned and operated by Norton Sound Health Corporation, a tribally-owned nonprofit organization. More than 100 construction workers will be employed on the hospital that should be completed in 2012. The $91 million was provided through the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act. The city of Sitka has thrown its support behind a pilot program to create a tribally run ferry service in the northern panhandle. Prior to its vote this week, the Sitka Assembly had postponed action three times previously on the so-called Short Sea Initiative while it wrestled with a basic problem. The tribal government launching the effort is Juneau's Tlingit and Haida Central Council, which has yet to solidify an agreement with the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. KCAW's Robert Woolsey reports.
The repositioning of the ferry Lakanti as a Juneau-based dayboat following its 2004 grounding was a major setback for transportation between Sitka and the neighboring villages of Cake, Angoon, and Huna. Restoring that service has been a high priority for local government, which has discussed creating a port authority to run its own ferries, modeled along the lines of the Inter-Island Ferry Authority, which serves Ketchikan and Prince of Wales Island. A proposal by the Tlingit and Haida Central Council for a $5 million pilot program to meet just this need has been well received in Sitka, especially since it would utilize a local contractor, Allen Marine. But Sitka's tribal government, the Sitka Tribe of Alaska, is understandably cautious. STA Councilman George Ridley presented the Assembly with a letter dated September 8 from Council Chairman Woody Widmark, stating that the tribe did not yet have enough information to support the project.
Everybody wants it. You know, it's just the way it's going to be done.
Ridley was joined by Jerry Hope, the transportation manager for the STA.
It's a great concept, and it, as the letter had identified, speaks to some of the critical concerns of access and transportation in and out of Sitka in terms of service transportation. However, there is a critical negative downside that we need to be very cautious about.
Pope holds a seat on the governor's Marine Transportation Advisory Board. He pointed out questions in Chairman Widmark's letter regarding Tlingit Ngāhaitis' interaction with the marine highway system and the effect of the pilot program on state ferry service to the villages. Perhaps most important, the chairman's letter objected to Tlingit Ngāhaitis' intention to claim inventory in the traditional territory of the Sitka Tribe of Alaska. Inventory in this case refers to transportation facilities eligible for Indian Reservation Roads funding from the Bureau of Indian Affairs. Yet another postponement of the resolution seemed likely to allow the Sitka Tribe and Tlingit Ngāhaitis time to reach an agreement. However, Sitka Mayor Scott McAdams thought it might be possible to move forward in a way that demonstrated strong support for both the project and the sovereign rights of the local tribe.
If we could put some sort of an amendment to this resolution, this is good for the city, and I think it'd be something that could be critically important to a local business of ours that is a great community business that's going to suffer a downturn in tourism, being Allen Marine. I want to support it, but I'd like to see some sort of amendment or something that would just put a qualifier in there that we do not support reducing formula dollars that are received by STA for transportation purposes as attached to this resolution. I think we could do it in a fashion that doesn't sink this idea.
The Assembly crafted a pair of amendments to the resolution. The first, that a memorandum of understanding between Tlingit Ngāhaitis and the Sitka Tribe to resolve uncertainty was essential to the pilot project. And the second, that the Sitka Tribe's federal transportation funding must be sustained. George Ridley and Jerry Hope had earlier in the evening urged delay. Hope now indicated that the addition of the amendments would strengthen the Sitka Tribe's ability to keep TNH at the table.
One fear is that if you adopt the overall resolution tonight, that there will be no incentive for Tlingit Ngāhaitis to work with Sitka Tribe of Alaska. Now, there might be some promises of City Assembly members to hold them to their word, but once you pass the resolution, you don't have any more leverage. So it would be really important to keep this amendment into the resolution.
Finally, there was some concern on the Assembly that the amendments were too prescriptive and inappropriately bound the sovereign tribal governments to an agreement that they may not reach. In the end, the economic opportunity represented by a trial ferry project and its limited nature outweighed those fears. The Assembly's vote on the amended resolution was unanimous. Reporting in Sitka, I'm Robert Woolsey.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. If you missed any of tonight's stories, we're online at APRN.org. Great reports tonight from Marsha Lynn in Homer, Lisa Fu in Wrangell, and Robert Woolsey in Sitka. APRN's Libby Casey reported from Washington, D.C., Dave Donaldson from Juneau, and Ellen Lockyer and Annie Fite from Anchorage. Our audio engineers are Gooseberry Peter and Dave Waldron, and I'm Laurie Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Wells Fargo, providing Alaskans steps to help reach their financial goals. Wells Fargo Bank, N.A. First National Bank Alaska, branches in 18 communities around the state and on the web at fnbalaska.com. Member FDIC, equal housing lender.
And by
Penn Air, providing scheduled service to 36 communities throughout Southwest Alaska. Reservations online at penair.com.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.